much of the Buddha, how much of the Dharma, how much of the Sangha? So today I am talking about inner peace or happiness, no matter what, and how Buddhism, I mean, part of me wants to say Buddhism's promise, but it only promises it if you practice. Buddhism teaches us that we can have inner peace. We can have happiness no matter what, no matter what our conditions. So first I wanted to start with a reading from a book by the Dalai Lama, Ethics for the New Millennium. He also has a book, I think, he has a number of books that talk about happiness. And, but in this one, he addresses it as well. So he says, "Let us now consider the nature of what I have characterized as genuine happiness. Here my own experience might serve to illustrate the state to which I refer. As a Buddhist monk, I have been trained in the practice, the philosophy, and the principles of Buddhism. But as to any sort of practical education to cope with the demands of modern living, I have received almost none. During the course of my life, I have had to handle enormous responsibilities and difficulties. At 16, I lost my freedom when Tibet was occupied. At 24, I lost my country itself when I came into exile. For 40 years now, I have lived as a refugee in a foreign country, albeit the one that is my spiritual home. Throughout this time, I have been trying to serve my fellow refugees and, to the extent possible, the Tibetans who remain in Tibet. Meanwhile, our homeland has known immeasurable destruction and suffering. And of course, I have lost not only my mother and other close family members, but also dear friends. Yet for all of this, although I certainly feel sad when I think about these losses, still so far as my basic serenity is concerned, on most days I am calm and contented. Even when difficulties arise, as they must, I am usually not bothered by them. I have no hesitation in saying I am happy. According to my experience, the principal characteristic of genuine happiness is peace, inner peace. By this, I do not mean some kind of feeling of being spaced out, nor am I speaking of an absence of feeling. On the contrary, the peace I am describing is rooted in concern for others and involves a high degree of sensitivity and feeling, although I cannot claim personally to have succeeded very far in this. Rather, I attribute my sense of peace to the effort to develop concern for others. This fact, that inner peace is the principal characteristic of happiness, explains the paradox that while we can all think of people who remain dissatisfied, despite having every material advantage, there are others who remain happy, notwithstanding the most difficult circumstances. So certainly our constitution, our upbringing, and our circumstances all contribute to our experience of happiness. And we can all agree that the lack of certain things makes its attainment all the harder. So let us consider these. Good health, friends, freedom, and a degree of prosperity are all valuable and helpful. Indeed, each of these factors plays an important part in establishing a sense of individual well-being. Yet without a basic feeling of inner peace and security, they are of no avail. Why? Because as we saw, our possessions are themselves a source of anxiety. So are our jobs insofar as we worry about losing them. Even our friends and relatives can become a source of trouble. They may get sick and need our attention when we are busy with important business. They may even turn against us and cheat us. Similarly, our bodies, however fit and beautiful they may be at the present, must eventually give in to old age. nor are we ever invulnerable to sickness and pain. Thus, there is no hope of attaining lasting happiness if we lack inner peace. Where, then, are we to find inner peace? There is no single answer, but one thing is for sure, no external factor can create it. So, he tends to use the terms happiness and inner peace interchangeably, but, and I think, you know, whatever you want to think of, if happiness is more appealing, that's fine. Sometimes happiness, like for me, makes me think of something that's a little more, maybe a little more giddy, a little more tends to be attached to conditional things or experiences, but, you know, inner peace seems like something that's a little more lasting, or maybe something that I want to be present, whether I'm feeling giddy with happiness or not. The inner peace is something that seems more essential. So in this time of uncertainty, I don't know about all of you, but I'm thinking of a lot of things that I rely on for my sense of security and peace and happiness and joy, and you know, somehow in a time of uncertainty. I mean, I don't know if your mind goes here. Certainly mine does, but mine tends to be quite prone to this. I think perhaps it's due to the fact that I almost lost my mom when I was 3 and a half. And somehow that triggered in me a sense of, I've always contemplated how ephemeral everything is in my life. People, relationships, things, how easily they can go. And then obviously at a time like this, think about it a lot. So I think about my home, my husband, my family, my pets, good food, health, healthcare, financial security, entertainment, peace, the beauty of nature, the joy of being able to do work that I am good at and enjoy doing, sangha. And I mean, we can all pray that everything gets back to normal, whatever that really means, as soon as possible. But you know, it's also mentions in the news about, you know, that the economic impact of what we've had to do might lead to something like the Great Depression. We already know, I mean, there already are people suffering, dying, losing their jobs and security. And again, I promise not to go on too long on a beautiful sunny Easter day about things sad and morbid, but you know, to some extent, the widespread suffering and breakdown of economies and social structures that we're seeing with the virus is to some extent just a preview of what's going to happen with the climate crisis sooner than later. So, you know, and that's like even something as what seems like as constant and reliable as the beauty of nature could be falling apart within my lifetime. And even when things are good, as the Dalai Lama said, you know, we stress because they can change. So where do we find that happiness, joy, inner peace, reason to live, when the unimaginable happens and we lose the things and conditions that make us happy, give us joy, provide us with security? Or how do we find that kind of unconditional inner peace before that, even before we lose those things, so that we can appreciate them and be more free from the concern about loss? So I was thinking about this, and a lot of times this is phrased in terms of, you know, there are these conditional sources of happiness, if you will, like the things that I just mentioned, and that you shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't take refuge in them because they're impermanent, you know, but you should cultivate these other things, cultivate these spiritual things, these more reliable things. But I was thinking about this another way, and how we can look, we can examine those things in our lives which bring us joy, bring us security, bring us peace, and to look at them, look deeply at them and ask what it is that they are giving us that is, you know, that is unconditional. That even if that particular manifestation, that particular person, that particular experience were to go away, you know, what unconditional is there? What is something that we wouldn't lose? So, for example, I'm just going to go through a list of a few categories of things. So, you know, loved ones. Loved ones are relationships, you know, for most of us, this is absolutely the most precious thing in our lives. The loss of loved ones, you know, is the worst human pain. You know, but what is unconditional, you know, within those relationships? What is not dependent on the presence of any particular individual in our lives? And I suppose there are different ways that you could think of this, but I was thinking about our capacity to love itself. That naturally we become very attached to particular people or animals. And there's no problem with this. It hurts a great deal when we lose those we love. But losing them or them losing us, that's not the end of love. I've heard it said that grief is just love in the face of loss. So in a way, grief is a testament to love. A manifestation of love. So in Buddhism, you know, what are these things that are underneath? I mean, we'll talk about metta, which can be translated as goodwill, loving kindness, friendliness. There's also the Brahmaviharas of compassion and sympathetic joy. Generosity is the first of the paramitas. Our precept talks about share understanding, give freely of self. I mean, morality in a large sense is about restraining our own desires and impulses so that we don't harm others. So it's really kind of an act of generosity about our relationships. Of course, there's bodhisattva service and vows. Dogen's four ways of the bodhisattva are giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action, being in the same boat with other beings. So no matter what happens, these things are available to us. And, you know, I mean, I think we all want to receive love and goodwill and metta and friendliness and all that. I mean, but even if we're not receiving it, we can give it. We can create that anytime, anywhere. So what about our physical comfort and safety? Lately, I've been feeling so grateful for having a safe and comfortable home, for plentiful and nutritious food, clean water, electricity, healthcare, medications, you know, vet care, pet food. I don't know if anybody else has been doing this, but sometimes I've been doing these things lately, like picking up this item, this medication, or this little like little dental chew for my dog or something, and just thinking, you know, thinking about who made this? Are the people who made these things, are they still working, the people who transported it, the people who sell it. Just like suddenly I'm becoming more aware of like, you know, this came from somewhere. And also thinking like, what if I lose access to some of this stuff in the future? I have some really good lotion that, you know, it really helps keep my face skin from getting dry. And as I look at it, I'm like, is this an essential product? Like, is this an essential job? Is the factory that makes this going to, you know, be operating no matter what? So I know, you know, my great-grandparents and grandparents made it through the Great Depression. But, you know, it leaps into my mind the tales of deprivation, the necessity for scrounging around and improvising to meet needs. And our physical comfort and security, I mean, that's something that we desire at a very basic instinctual level. So, you know, that's definitely true. But underneath all of that, I mean, not in spite of that basic instinctual need and desire for safety and comfort and sustenance, but at a deeper level, I think we just desire to know that we're okay. I mean, many of us, I've heard many people say, like, they're not even afraid of dying per se. It's just more, you know, the conditions that might lead up to that, or the loss, the suffering that might be endured, that, you know, experiencing loss or pain or situations where we can't maintain that inner peace anymore, that you know, that sense of life being worth living, life having some joy, that sense of happiness might go away. Now, the Dalai Lama, I skipped it over, but he was talking about observing the Tibetan people when thousands of them fled Tibet shortly after he was exiled, and how they were living in these refugee camps, and they had basically just had tents. They had Tibetan clothing that was way too warm for the Indian climate. You know, they were suffering physically a lot, but he said they actually most of them were peaceful and happy. They were grateful to have been able to get out and to be free. And he also mentioned kind of a interesting example, but of a soldier on a battlefield and getting injured, but you've won the battle and it's a righteous battle. Like so there might be injury or suffering, but it has some meaning, it has some context. So really, no matter our conditions, it is possible to relate to our circumstances in a way that allows us dignity or meaning or inner peace, if not happiness. And this is really what our practice is fundamentally about, facing the great matter of life and death head on, trying to taste the unconditioned aspect of existence, the just as it isness, the just this moment, which is precious and luminous no matter what's going on, no matter what changes. And, you know, to some extent, anticipation of loss, of physical comfort and security, in some ways is worse, not in many ways not, but in some ways is worse than the actual experience. Now, those who are living in, you know, extreme poverty or are homeless, you know, may be struggling to survive and facing many different kinds of suffering. But there's one suffering that they're relatively free from, and that is living in dread of what if. There it is. The kind of the worst has already happened. I mean, there's a kind of, I think, you know, in times when I have talked to, interacted with houseless folks, and there's a part of me that wants to, you know, hear about their experience and how, like, how upsetting and terrible and, you know, like, because to me that seems like so extreme, but for them, now it's like, well, here I am. I mean, what are you gonna do? So there's a certain kind of peace that can be present even in the midst of those kinds of situations. What are you gonna do next? So no matter our conditions, we do have Buddha nature, we can practice and we can strive to connect with those deeper truths which are apply no matter what. Now what about pleasure? What about, it's just no getting around the fact that, a lot of what boosts my mood, what counteracts, bad news or dread or sadness, I have good company. I'm able to connect electronically with you all and with my friends and family. I have a beautiful yard outside. I can go around, I can look at the flowers and the things that are growing and the birds that are singing and attracting mates, and I'm able to continue doing the things I enjoy. My husband bakes and cooks delicious food. My dogs are a company. There's plenty of entertaining stuff to watch on Netflix and Prime. What about these sources of these obviously conditional sources of joy and pleasure? Now, I mean, these are the kinds of things obviously that are easily lost, but really at the core of all of them, what is, again, to just look and like, what is something unconditional that I benefit from in this situation? And again, you might think of something else, but I thought about gratitude. As long as we're alive, there will be something to be grateful for. Maybe things will get difficult. We won't be able to really appreciate what we have, or we'll be stuck thinking about the stuff that we don't have anymore or that we wish we had. But this is where this takes practice, right? It's not just something instant. But it's always possible for us to cultivate gratitude, no matter what our conditions and situations are. And I saw this very played out very dramatically and sweetly when I was working as a CNA in long-term care facilities, and there would be older folks that, had very little left. They didn't have health. They often didn't have much in the way of relationships, certainly no independence. Their mind might be going. So they didn't have much left. And so some people ended up, kind of bitter or mad or something. But, there was the occasional person that just, I walk in the room, I'm going to bring them some water. And they're grateful for that. They're just like, hello. Oh, thank you, dear. And, there's part of me that just thought, oh, if I can just cultivate the habit of gratitude enough that, when I am in that kind of situation, that is what comes out. That would be a great, great success. So, in conclusion, suggest that when we find ourselves thinking about whether, if you're thinking about this the way that I am sometimes, whether you'll be able to maintain your happiness or at least inner peace, a sense that life is worth it, no matter what happens, no matter how our society changes, no matter what we end up having to do without, that then we look deeper than the particular object or person or being or activity that's bringing us happiness, peace, comfort, security. And I guess find the unconditional source of meaning or joy or peace there, like love itself or generosity, kindness, gratitude, a sense that everything is strangely precious just as it is. recognize all of our stuff are just ways that we access those deeper things that make our lives worth it. That the stuff and our circumstances can change drastically, but the unconditioned will always be accessible. So we can access inner peace no matter what. And some of us have been tested in this regard, given our life circumstances. Some of us have not. I don't really feel like I have been tested in the way that my grandparents and great-grandparents were during World War II and the Great Depression. But I'm not different than they are. You know, we're not different than they are. So, I'll leave it there and open it up for any comments or questions. There's few enough of us so that if you just want to unmute yourself and say something, please go ahead.
I have just one comment to make before I contribute to your talk. I got blacked out and it says I can't start the video at my end.
Huh. Did you do that, Bob? You're muted.
Yeah. What was that? I'm sorry, yeah, Shay. I was working trying to find a way to improve Domio's image because her voice and stuff weren't matching. And it didn't help. And I couldn't restart it without going and asking you to restart it.
So was I breaking up when I talked?
Yeah, there was a mismatch between your voice and the image.
But did the audio ever like pause and break up?
No, the audio was good.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I should make a habit of, before we start the talk, warning that people that might happen, like I had to do with Gyokoko, just that, you know, we may turn your video off midway.
That's fine. I just wanted to let you know I didn't black myself out.
Okay, good.
So can you get yourself started again? Yes,
nope. Oh.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to start.
It's okay. I'm just like I said, I'm just putting it out there that I'm with you guys. Hi, I'm here. That's all.
Okay.
Did you want to make a comment too then?
Snagged. Well, you covered so much. One of the things in my just doing Zazen this morning with you, anytime I would leave, when I would bring myself back, I would tell myself, your happiness, your peace is right here in the present moment. Why do you keep leaving me? Come on back. And so that's like almost the mantra that I was using to bring me back, and then just observing how there were different sensations or textures, whether it was in Kinhin or not. And again, with my mind would go, I'd say, why do you keep leaving? Your happiness is right here. And that's what I would use to bring me back. Those flowers in your yard, they're not here right now. This is where you are right now. So that's one thing that touched me. Also, what you shared at the end about being in a facility with seniors and being aware of the situation I'm in now, where there is no gratitude for anything that's being offered, but still keep showing up. And now they are looking at the possibility of having to move again. And again, this is perhaps selfish, but I was also saying, may I cultivate within me an attitude of gratitude and reverence that stays with me right till my last moments when I'm in a situation where I'm not able to care for myself. I'll leave it like that.
Thank you. Go ahead, Amelia. You just got to unmute yourself.
Hi. It's so wonderful to see everybody and to meditate together. There's something about a group meditation that I just find so invigorating to my practice. It's wonderful, and I love doing it on Zoom, even though I show an avatar when I'm meditating because, you know, I might want to scratch my head or something. But thank you so much for the talk today. That really has hit home. And I've been thinking about a dear, dear friend of mine who lives in New York City and has for many years. And he has lived through the AIDS crisis as a gay man in New York City, lost many friends through 9/11, and now through this. And he lost one of his oldest friends a week or so ago, over a week ago with COVID. And his body is being kept in one of those white trucks that is actually parked right down the street from his apartment. And so he goes and just sits with him as he can, you know. And he's having cancer surgery this week. And yet his Facebook posts are so, he just walks every day, sometimes with a couple of friends 6 feet apart, but he walks every day. He loves the city so much, and his pictures are always so beautiful, but now they're just especially just poignant, but just, you know, just the emptiness of the streets. There's just, he says there's such a feeling of peace and solitude even in the streets, and his pictures just convey this serenity that, and knowing him, speaking to him, you know, he also conveys that serenity. And I'm in awe that, you know, I mean, these are, you know, this is really happening. It's really happening to people. And it's like, you know, our parents going through, my parents went through both world wars and depression and everything else, but they're just like us, and we find our peace where we find it. And I think that we find a way to meet it. We just do. And cultivating a spiritual life, I think, just makes you a lot more well-equipped. I hope. I haven't been tested too badly, but yeah. So.
Thank you.
This talk kind of reminded me of last week's talk about impermanence. I don't know, somehow they come together in my mind, or else last week, or was the week before, maybe, talk about impermanence really stuck with me. I have a lot of fear of losing what I have, I'll be honest. I mean, I grew up in a lot of poverty and had a lot of nothing, and my own father died. He was homeless when he died. I've had lots of fear of that. I have wonderful things in my life and people in my life, my children, my own family, and I fight that all the time. So I appreciate too just being here with everybody because it makes me feel normal-ish. Like, yes, that's how people feel, we feel that way, and yet And life is impermanent. Things are impermanent, and we will feel pain and we will feel loss, and there it's going to kind of move through, and I'm going to be afraid. And then when it happens, I'll probably be okay. Or maybe I won't. I don't know. I don't like, this is what my mind goes through. Oh. But just having the comfort of being around other people. In our breakout rooms, we were talking about orchids, which was like wonderful and enjoyable to me, especially, you know, living alone and not talking to a lot of people. So I don't know really where I'm going with this, but just the what I've been feeling and thinking is about impermanence, loss, acceptance, moving through, enjoying, having some kind of inner peace by the grace of I don't know what, hopefully some of my practice. I don't know how well I practice, but hopefully that contributes. And again, a community of people that are also human and experiencing what I experience. So some gratitude at that for that.
Yeah, thanks for being willing to share the concerns. I mean, everybody's different. Some people think about this stuff, some people don't, but I think, I don't know. I definitely think about it a lot.
Thank you very much, Domio. A great subject, great topic. And it made me think about this morning. I live in Northwest Portland, and my life kind of began in this little neck of the woods. And I'm back again now in my 60s living in Northwest Portland. And I figured out the only way to really get out is to get up very early. And I've walked down to the waterfront. And I was thinking about that, you know, especially with Amelia talking about in New York, walking in your city when it's so quiet. And it was a beautiful walk, beautiful morning, and I stopped to smell the lilacs. I saw this goose just standing on a pillar, and I felt peace. And then I felt guilty for having peace, you know, because all this stuff is going on. And I mean, seriously, there was no cars on the road, just a few dog walkers and some cyclists and me. And it was a weird back and forth feeling of I'm okay, but wow, this all this stuff is going on. Yeah, I really appreciated this talk. It was right on. Thank you very much.
There's a I mean one way that I've thought about Zen practice, maybe all profound spiritual practices, but is increasing our tolerance for ambiguity, which is actual like psychological term of, you know, being able to hold apparently contradictory things in our experience at the same time, and not stressing us out too much, to recognize that is the nature of life. And you know, it's easier said than done, right? So, I mean, cultivating the actual ability to do that is, you know, that sense of gratitude when, you know, when we're encountering something that we know we're going to lose, perhaps soon even, and yet being able to be aware of that, but then shift to gratitude, you know, of just this moment, not thinking about the loss, but thinking about the preciousness of, well, this person, this thing, whatever, it's here right now. You know, it's like we're kind of aware of both at the same time. I don't know if you ever heard that. It's widely quoted, like Ajahn Chah or something said, you know, he had this teacup, right, that he really loved, and somebody was criticizing him for, you know, why do you value this? Why do you, you know, appreciate this so much? It's just a thing. It's just an impermanent thing. And he says, well, that's why, you know, it's broken. It's already broken. You know, it's impermanence is part of its nature. And that is one of the things that makes it so precious.
Hello, Domya?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you for this talk today. It reminded me of a moment of glory that I had when I was 4 years old. Mm. My father died unexpectedly. Mm. And you know how little girls love their dads best. I missed him very much. And for the next year and a half, I slept with his picture under my pillow at night. At any time, I could make myself cry just by thinking about him. Mm-hmm. And one day, I had this enlightenment, sort of, where I thought, well, gosh, if I can make myself cry just by thinking about something, I can make myself joyful by thinking about something else. Mm. That was kind of the beginning of my realization that I had control over my mind. And it wasn't until I was in college that I took a course in Buddhism, or actually it was religions of the non-Western world, that I became aware that, oh my, other people have had this realization as well. So anyway, that has been a force in my life for 69 years. And your talk brought it back to me today. And I appreciate it very much. And to give other people encouragement that you do have control over your mind and you can see the glory in things and see the beauty in things, even during dark hours.
Thank you, that's beautiful. I think there's a, I don't know if anybody else is concerned about this, but I know I resisted in practice the suggestion in a way that I could control my own mind for a particular reason that I didn't want to shut off my concern and compassion for the world. You know, like maybe there's some kind of practice or some kind of teaching or some kind of insight that I could avail myself of and I'll feel better and I won't be as bothered by the suffering in the world. You know, so kind of in that way it would be, you know, kind of spiritual bypassing or a certain kind of denial or something like that. So for myself, I was always worried that if I applied the spiritual training too well, that I might shut down my receptivity and compassion for the world. So that's why, I mean, eventually I recognize through experience that if I was really present and really open and really applied the practice, that I wasn't shutting anything out, that receptivity and that awareness and that potential for compassion was still very much alive. But I've continued to work with that question. And that's why, I mean, before the virus came around and I was focused on the climate crisis and I was kind of formulating a new way to approach practice holistically. And part of it was the sense of recognizing that our practice needed to have three different components. That one is, you know, kind of that internal, like taking care of ourselves through spiritual practice and or otherwise. And one is bearing witness. And then one is, and then taking action. So the idea is that the bearing witness part, as bodhisattvas, we need to, that needs to be a component in our practice, but it needs to be balanced. So that bearing witness is, I think in this case, is just staying aware of what is going on in our world to some extent. First of all, so we know what's going on, we can make the right decisions, but also, you know, bearing witness is just being with others in their suffering. It's just, you know, even if we're not suffering, to be aware of that, to hold it in our hearts somehow. But then to recognize that if we do too much bearing witness, we just get exhausted and depressed and anxious and whatever. So that needs to be balanced with the taking care. And I mean, I don't know how other people feel about this, but since I've been starting to look at it that way, of recognizing that these different aspects that they both need to be present, they both need to be balanced, that knowing that I'm doing enough, I'm doing some bearing witness, I'm doing that, really helps me be more completely wholehearted in the, like, taking care, taking a break, enjoying myself part. Because I know I'm not avoiding things, I'm not neglecting being a bodhisattva. That's part of being a bodhisattva. And I can just, you know, like, I do my bearing witness, and then I go out in my garden, you know, look at the flowers without any sense of guilt. Well, I don't know if that anybody relates to that or not, but
yeah, that makes sense. I feel like that's part of what we glean from sitting, is the self-awareness to know how much bearing witness is enough and how much is too much for us.
I think I really appreciate what you said. I don't think that I erase that. I enjoy what you said about the importance of bearing witness. And then including myself in that compassion, meaning that I need to take care of myself, meaning I'm not drowning in bearing witness, but also taking walks, being out in nature, doing what I can. And one of the things that you already know is that I'm also calling different hospitals to offer donations of surgical masks. And I would like, if you'd permit me, to share a poem of gratitude that the main Dharma teacher wrote to us. It says, unstained in the dusty, it's very tiny, unstained in the dusty world, our hearts flow. In birth and death, great doubt grows. Flocks of bodhisattvas responding and connecting. Beings are freed and selves are let go. May you all be healthy and free.
Thank you.
To me, that kind of is in alignment with the bearing witness, taking care of yourself, and also rising to action.
I'm finding myself, I'm actually enjoying these little silences when we're people aren't jumping in to talk. That I don't know if it feels like when I was a teenager and I would call my friends on the phone and we'd talk and talk and talk, and then sometimes we'd just sit there, run out of things to say, but we were still connected.
My sister-in-law told me about, she has two meditation groups. She lives in Eugene, and she has a friend, and they call each other by phone. I think she has a flip phone, so I don't think she has a smartphone. So they call each other by phone, and then they set the timer for 20 minutes, and they meditate silently together, and then they say thank you and goodbye. And it meant a lot to me, because I think that the idea that meditating with someone or with a group is feels more real somehow for me. Mm-hmm. And so I really love our online Zazen. And it doesn't... I think this must be unique to each of us, that for some people the Zoom media is feels distant, and then but what I notice is that feels connected to me. I feel like we're in the same space because we're in the same activity.
Well, it's true that our core activity is like sitting still, silently next to each other. So it's really not all that different.
That's one of the things I'm very grateful for, being able to meditate with you all. I also meant to say, I don't mind the silences. I like them. They're fine.
Can you hear my neighbor mowing his lawn?
Thank you.
About the... climate crisis. Mm-hmm. And I know many of you are already aware of this, how they can see the Himalayas for the first time in 30 years. And a friend of mine in Los Angeles says that Los Angeles has the best air quality it's had in decades. So there's a part of me that said, maybe the coronavirus was an outcry from the earth itself saying, pay attention, wake up, and in a way, asking for healing, and is in a way having some healing, even while at the same time there are bills being signed to give away more land to be raped and destroyed. But I know that's a fantasy thought, but... I'm still grateful that there was a little healing opportunity out there for the climate and the earth.
Well, and we know it's demonstrated what's possible. Mm-hmm. So much of we've said, oh, no, we can't do that. But when the crisis seems immediate, then actually a lot is possible.
Well, immediate for people, not immediate for the earth.
Exactly. I'll just say the closing verse. We offer the merit of this practice session to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas,
Mahasattvas.
Wisdom beyond wisdom. Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Domio.
Thank you, Domio.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Thank you, Domio.
Have a great day.